And we're back with David Darcy and our regular visitors, Ann Thompson, John Sloss, and a welcome new addition, Richard Lorber. You know, in terms of how Sundance is dealing with the new commercial age, during her prepared remarks at the opening press conference, Carrie Putnam had some remarks about that. So I just wanted to play a little bit of that and see what you guys think.
Yeah. Well, we recognize that this sort of public square is in short supply right now. The consolidation of commercial media, the click optimization of the digital landscape, that means that stories, content, and information are being distributed with an eye on views and clicks rather than depth and risk. It's commerce, not purpose, that's driving most storytelling, which of course is fine as far as it goes, but it's dangerous when there's few alternatives. This leads to the most shallow and sensational content being prioritized. The commercial media environment devalues independent media, and we're here to revalue it.
Wait. Speaking as a journalist whose profession has been devalued, this is the woman who's speaking is doing a great job. Is also presenting the Michael Jackson documentary. So you know, we're all a part of this whole thing. Anne.
What I would say is that the news media is here. There are people tweeting their opinions all over. It's an amplification of what you were describing earlier, Richard. There are people here seeing movies and discovering them and amplifying them, and it's okay. It's okay. As far as Leaving Neverland is concerned, that is a valuable, hard-hitting, brutal, must-see documentary, and I applaud it, and so did everyone at the theater yesterday.
By a very good filmmaker, very, very good filmmaker. John.
Clearly, there's something in what Carrie's saying, as there always is. There's going to be a consolidation in sort of big-box streaming SVOD offerings, but I think at the same time there's going to be a growth of more targeted offerings, and we're involved with some of them. And so I don't think particular voices and particular constituencies are going to be left out in the cold here.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be always accommodated. It's often the marketplace that makes it much more challenging to monetize those voices from the outside.
I'm curious what you guys think of the disappearance of the Amazon Direct Video Festival floor.
It was a nice surprise for it to exist. Tell us
what it is.
Amazon had a program called Film Festival Stars, where they provided what they called bonuses or license fees to films that were in certain festivals in certain categories. And it was more, in effect, than you would normally expect to get from a streaming service. And there was an opportunity to get a fee for films that ordinarily wouldn't be even sold to the Amazons or Netflixes. So it was a boon to the independents, but it also distorted the landscape for some very small films that, frankly, we wound up paying considerably more for because of the Amazon fee than we would have in the normal course of what they were worth. So in the net sum effect of it is that the films weren't really benefiting from this, although some films that wouldn't have seen theatrical release did. We regret the loss of it, but in some ways it was a distortion of the reality and the economics of the independent business.
But does it mean that some of those small-scale movies, low-budget films, won't get any release at all?
That some of them won't, and some of them don't deserve to, frankly.
Okay, let's. We've got a film called Untouchable about Harvey Weinstein. For years, Harvey Weinstein was one of the people who defined this business. Was there a Weinstein era? Is it over? Has somebody filled the very large space that Harvey Weinstein occupied? And what's the evidence that we may have turned a page on that, besides Harvey coming under criminal accusations?
There was definitely a Harvey Weinstein era. As a salesperson, we always liked Harvey because he would often kickstart the market. Now there's a lot of, although notwithstanding what happened last night with Amazon, there's a lot of waiting until all the films screen, and then people sort of buyers try to take the energy out of the marketplace to their advantage. And Harvey, if he saw something and liked it, would just go for it and didn't analyze it. That the Harvey Weinstein era has been over for quite a while, and this Untouchable wouldn't exist if the era was still in place. I mean, I think Harvey expected that he was going to do what he was going to do, and then he was going to die and let people pick up the pieces after he died. And what happened is it happened before, and it's because his power receded.
Well,
I do notice that HBO has been very strong at this festival. They came in with Native Son. They paid 8 figures for it. That's a lot of money.
How much did they pay?
I don't know, but 8 figures is what was reported, and that took it right out of the theatrical market. It's not going to have a theatrical release. A very good movie. And then they also have Leaving Neverland coming in.
And the for those of us in Part City with the some memory of Sundance. Harvey always embodied that this cutthroat atmosphere of going after pictures. The legendary story, I think it was like out of 1996 when he thought he had acquired the movie Shine, and some other concern slipped under...
Fineline, I think it was.
Yeah, it was.
And a legendary incident where he just went ballistic on somebody at a restaurant at the bottom of Main Street.
There was only one restaurant at the bottom of Main Street.
Well, the bad news is that what was also going on here at Sundance that nobody talks about are horrible things at the Stein Erickson and people being assaulted and allegedly.
Richard, you're remarkably quiet.
I'm just waiting for a moment to talk about the mountain.
Let's look at the other side of that. Meg Whitman is now running a company. Is it called Cubed? That is specializing in small screen, device-sized screen, short films, monetized by or capitalized by Jeffrey Katzenberg and all sorts of other people. I feel as if I'm describing the Elizabeth Holmes story in another incarnation. But is that the future? Shorter things for the short attention span on the smallest possible screens? John, what do you think?
I think the future is, the digital future that's broken away from the limitations of television and time periods is stories being told at the right length, whether they're 7 minutes long or whether they're 11 hours long. Mm-hmm. And that's only a good thing. And eyeballs are eyeballs, and if they're watching it on a 4-inch screen, maybe they won't get the same impact as on IMAX, but I don't see it as a bad thing.
Richard, can you give us the 3-second response to that?
I agree with John. We've released films that are 13 and a half hours. Rivette's Out One is 13 and a half hours. And we've released some films that are under an hour. We haven't gotten down to 7 minutes yet, but the future is near.
I'd say the first 12 hours of Out really dragged.
I mean, but everyone stayed for the last hour.
When Ted Sarandos told me he was going to drop House of Cards all at once, I said, "You're insane. Why would you ever do that?" And I was completely wrong, and it started a revolution.
Okay, we've got to work in the Oscars. Ann Thompson is here, who is our resident or visiting specialist. And we've got an executive producer of The Green Book. Who was that again? Was it John Sloss?
It's Green Book.
Oh, God. Thank you, John. Green Book. You want to take, and we got the distributor of Fathers and Sons, and Best Picture?
Roma. I think Roma is going to take it, but there's some interesting scenarios if you look at it. I mean, maybe The Favorite gets Olivia Colman, maybe Spike Lee wins Best Director for Black Klansman. Maybe Mahershala Ali wins for Green Book. I think John is hoping that the PGA win is forecasting a Best Picture win, which it sometimes does for Green Book, but I'm not sure what it's going to win.
Well, as a sage in Hollywood told me, the only people who like Green Book are the audience.
Yeah, Judge, let me ask you. John, were there people saying, it's retro. It's a friendship between a black person and a white person. Neither one gets shot by a policeman, and it's like Driving Mr. Daisy. It's so retro. And given the success and the nominations of the picture,
But given the present, the public wants retro, I would think. Given what's happening right now, I would think retro ain't bad. John's shaking his head. Yeah. I think he has.
If you've got 13 hours, we can get into this.
Give us the 13-second. Come on, we're in the small format.
I think I just did. Okay. people like Green Book. There's certain people who I think resent the fact that they like it as much as they do, or that other people do. And you know,
I think there are a lot of people, mainly forgive my French, white men, who actually defiantly love Green Book and defiantly defend a movie that is often told from the white point of view.
Okay, does the fact that the family has been saying this isn't accurate, all that, does that mean anything?
That's a longer conversation.
I would say that it has not been as sticky as you might think. That's what I mean. I think that people who like the movie are digging in their heels and saying, I really like this movie.
And Deadline posted yesterday some audio tapes from Dr. Shirley and from Tony Lip, where they spoke directly about their relationship with each other. And there were only two people in that car, and they're both no longer with us. So they're the ones who know what their relationship was.
But in the among the voting, does something like that play, or is that a secondary issue? Do you think?
I mean, we'll find out. But I think Anne's probably right. And I would say the film's been playing to all demographics. We've screened it for all demographics. There is this perception that it plays, to white audiences primarily. At least when we tested it, it tested the same for every demographic and all diversity.
Richard,
I've got a bite on this because, for the Oscar discussion next year, we'll be talking about The Mountain.
It's a superb film by Rick Alverson, very talented American auteur. Starring Jeff Goldblum and Ty Sheridan, which is in the spotlight section here. It was in Venice, and we saw it and fell head over heels. It's a truly unique, unsynopsizable film that's about a lobotomist in the 50s, played by Jeff Goldblum. Should I say more?
No. But wait a minute. Could you say something about the Oscars that are about to happen without mentioning them?
In the foreign category, which we're close to, as well as the documentaries, I admire greatly Never Look Away. It's a film that probably won't come to the foreground as the winner, but it's a film that brings together themes of cultural origination and the creative process, deals with artists like story based on Gerhard Richter and Joseph Beuys, both of which were documentaries which we released, and this is a film that captures the essence of the torture of creativity.
Right. Gerhard Richter, who has said he's only seen the trailer but doesn't like the film.
I can understand that, and that's part of his position as an artist.
Somehow I think Gerhard Richter's perspective is not going to affect the American audience for this film.
Can I just chime in? I'd be remiss in self-promotion if I didn't mention that Synetics involved with three of the other four documentary nominees, and it's going to be a very exciting category this year.
Is
Free Solo will win.
Really?
There you go, and that's one of ours.
Okay.
No, it'll be between, I'm being a little bit glib, Free Solo versus RBG.
Another one of ours.
Which okay. Was a huge hit.
Did anybody, does anybody have any role in Shoplifters? John, is that yours?
No.
Okay. Is Capernaum one of yours?
Yes, from a law firm perspective, yes.
Okay, and Never Look Away? No.
I would say Cold War is the one that would probably challenge Roma in that category. If people are afraid Roma isn't going to win Best Picture, they will definitely vote for it for Foreign, I would suspect.
Cold War, which is Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Pavel Pavlikovsky, fabulous movie.
Best Director, Richard?
Spike Lee.
John? Oh, well, this guy's so conflicted.
Alfonso. I have nothing to do with it. I have issues with the theatricality of Roma and how it was treated, but Alfonso Cuarón is brilliant.
It's the biggest theatrical release Roma has ever given a film because
Netflix
Netflix. What did I say? Roma. Alfonso Cuarón dictated that, and I'm not sure what the future will bring for other films, except maybe Martin Scorsese's The Irishman.
Anything to add to that, Richard?
I think the field is surprisingly open this year, except for Roma, and that's a healthy condition, and I applaud the fact that there's some diversity that's emerging, if not enough yet.
And can you address the declining audience for the Oscars? Talk about that.
Well, they seem to think that the perfect host is the answer. And this year, even though they were trying to come up with some best popular film category, there are a lot of popular films in the race, including Black Panther. And I think there are going to be people rooting for A Star Is Born and these big movies that are actually in the race this year. And that's what it's going to come down to. I predict the even without a host, which they never found because Kevin Hart imploded, I think they're going to be fine. I think their numbers will be up.
How do you feel about that, John?
Well, I was on record saying, you know, they failed in trying to institute the popular film, which was clearly, or pressured from the network, from ABC.
Right.
And what they ended up getting was popular films as nominees for the first time in about 10 years, really at the proliferation. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody.
What I love is the idea that even if Roma was this little tiny art house movie, which actually did very well in theaters, even if it wasn't handled as well as you might have liked.
That's funny because we don't have any data about how
it
did. We do.
We have Tom Brueggemann counting seats in different theaters and figuring out an estimate of about $3 million for that film based on the fact that it's still holding in theaters a month after it went wide on Netflix, which in 190 countries.
Isn't that also part of the campaign to keep it in the theaters?
It was only in the theaters because it's performing in the theaters. But the idea is that people all over the world have seen it. It's been seen by more people than possibly A Star Is Born.
So, Richard, what does that say about the potential for foreign language films? I mean, you're one of the people who's distributing a lot of them.
The frustration with is the distortion of the kind of resources that were applied to Roma against what is appearing to be a lack of commitment by Netflix to pick up any other international films. The reality is that they've receded from the foreground of showing the best of international cinema. You can't give away a foreign film to Netflix for the most part these days, despite the amount of commitment and resources they applied to Roma. And that's the distortion that's I think, unhealthy.
Mm. Completely agree.
What film? Give me an example of a film that would have benefited from that from additional resources.
Oh, I can describe.
I can list a
film like ours, Custody, which is winning all the Caesars in France right now. The French film that we released last year, which is a brilliant film by Xavier Legrand, which the French mistakenly did not include as their Oscar submission, but will win, you know, seven or eight Caesars probably. That's a film that would have been perfect for Netflix. There are, probably six or seven other films. We have the new Godard film that's just opened to raucously favorable reviews in the New York Times. The Image Book, that's a film that would benefit from a Netflix window. We sold them the previous film from Godard, Goodbye to Language. And now I don't think I'll get my phone call answered if I ask them to consider this.
Oh, really? What you think? And Netflix is listening to this program, I'm sure.
They're dear friends. They've been very supportive, and they've helped me stay in business and grow my company. And I've known Ted Sarandos for 15 years, and I'm still am hopeful that they'll see room in the market for more films that are not going to get the kind of support.
So
of
Netflix is becoming Netflix is the new mountain for you.
They're the biggest studio in Hollywood.
I mean, they've done a brilliant job with Roma of disguising the fact that 95% of people who watch this beautiful cinematic film are going to be watching it on a small screen. And if that's okay with the Academy, then I guess that's where we're going.
The backlash that everybody predicted for Netflix didn't occur when Roma got 10 Oscar nominations, and so did. And The Ballad of Buster Scruggs got 3.
Okay, let's talk about the festival, what's coming up in the festival. And, okay, what are you guys watching for viability and for quality, particularly in the scripted dramatic features, which I think a lot of us have, you know, kind of placed in a secondary position since the docs are so strong. What are you looking at, Richard?
I'm not going to tip my hand. Sorry.
I'm sorry. The Mountain?
I can safely say we're looking at that. We're looking at people who are looking at that.
Good.
I want to see The Farewell, which played last night, the Awkwafina movie, personal story from this filmmaker, Lulu Wang. I can't wait to see that.
Okay, John, so what should people buy since Green Book is already bought?
Well, I'll move back to documentaries for a second. Knock Down the House, starring Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is a wonderful film, and it's a zeitgeist film of the moment, and I think it's going to play very well.
She's a bigger personality than almost anybody in the film business right now. I mean, in the media.
She knows how to use Twitter.
Well, yes, she does. Yeah. Yes, she does. She knows how to respond.
I think Richard? And I think she represents the part of Queens where you and I should go and eat some great Chinese food.
We've been talking about this is a guy who's I'm there. He's talking about it.
Okay. Yeah. if you can do that without culturally appropriating. But
well, the whole thing is culturally appropriating. Yeah. That's what they want. That's what we're buying.
We thank our annual guests, Anna Thompson from IndieWire, John Sloss from Synetic Media.
Very well named.
And Richard Lorber of Kino Lorber. Glad to see you.
Okay, I just want to break a story. Kino Lorber is now changing its name officially to The Mountain.
We keep climbing, everyone.
Us down and we're back with Sundance Reel on the Weekend with my co-host David Darcy, and now we have a film that's in the special events section of Sundance, which means it premiered elsewhere. The director Joshua Raffe, where did the film premiere, Josh?
This is the premiere, actually.
Oh, the special event.
Yeah.
Usually they call it special when it played at some other festival.
Oh, no. This is the world premiere.
Okay. I know David is bursting with questions, but just this is the story of John Wayne Bobbitt and Lorena Bobbitt, a story that was a lot of tabloid fodder in the 90s. And what is there new to say about this, Josh? What it looks like every cable channel that does true crime and court TV, and it seems like we've had half a dozen documentaries about this.
The truth is, what should be said or what should have been said has never been said until our series. When people hear the name Lorena Bobbitt, they think of a crazed, approximately middle-aged white woman who, in a fit of rage, cut her husband's penis off and threw it out the car window. And that's about all that they remember. When in reality, Lorena was a 23-year-old immigrant from Venezuela who came here in search of the American dream when she was 18. And she thought she found it when she found this, she met this handsome, charming Marine named John Wayne Bobbitt. And they had a very very old-fashioned courtship. They had about 10 months of chaperone dating. She was still a virgin, and they got married. And according to her, a few weeks into the marriage, he hit her for the first time. And she had two thoughts. The first was, I can't believe this person I love hit me. And the second was, I'm sure he'll never do it again. And Lorena alleges that this began the next approximately 4 years of incessant beatings, rapes, sodomy on a regular basis. And so there's an entire side to this that really has never been explored. And this is a story that happened to coincide with the birth of the 24-hour news cycle. So instead of being local fodder, or local legend, it happened at a time where virtually overnight it became world news.
Okay, so in a lot of cases of stories like this, the filmmaker has to find the people involved and twist their arms, do whatever it takes to get them to talk. It seems from watching the film that each one was interested in telling his and her own story. What's different about getting these people to talk, and what does that say about their relationship to the story?
I mean, I think for Lorena, and I'll start with her because she's the reason I wanted to make this series.
The film's called Lorena, not John Wayne Bobbitt.
Exactly. With Lorena, she felt like she'd never really said her piece. All she wanted 25 years ago or whatever it was, was to sort of disappear into a quiet life and disappear into anonymity and try and reclaim her soul and build the life that she came to America dreaming of having, which was all she wanted was a quiet, regular life. And so for her, I think that she felt it was finally an opportunity to, you know, to go to the places that she knew she had never gone publicly, you know, with telling her side of the story. I reached out to her and I sent her links to my previous films. The first one is called Lost for Life. It's about juveniles who are serving life without parole, all guilty of brutal first-degree murders. But of course, there was horrific trauma that they had suffered long before they committed their crimes. And my second one is called Swift Current, and it tells the story of a former NHL player named Sheldon Kennedy who was sexually abused by his junior hockey coach when he was a kid. And the film explores the long-term effects of childhood sexual abuse.
Okay, so
and so she could see from my previous work that telling a story rooted in trauma was something that I'd spent the previous decade on.
So explain to our audience who may not remember this. Neither of them did any time. Not John Bobbitt didn't do any time for beating Lorena. Lorena didn't do any time for cutting off his private part. Why not?
Well, it's an interesting thing. His trial was first, and actually it was not televised. So a lot of people forget he even had a trial. And due to Virginia law, the jury was only allowed to consider... he was on trial for sexually assaulting his wife. And due to Virginia law, the jury was only allowed to consider the previous 5 days as opposed to the four-year history of the relationship. And that very much played in his favor, and he was acquitted. But even jurors who we spoke to who were in the series, they thought it was clear that in their heart of hearts, they believed he had done this. But as one juror says, you cannot vote with your heart. You have to vote with the evidence that you have been presented with. And then for Lorena, she was acquitted, but found not guilty by reason of insanity. It's really hard to prove insanity, obviously, and irresistible impulse specifically was her defense.
Right, and irresistible impulse is, define what that is, and also tell us, if a sharp knife was within reach and so available at that moment, it seems a little less spontaneous than having, you know, the right instrument there at the right time, so to speak.
I mean, this is really for you, the viewer, to consider for yourself, I think, whether or not you agree with the verdict in her case and whether or not you believe that irresistible impulse was, in fact, what she suffered from.
It wasn't unprecedented at that time to suggest that, you know, a victim of domestic abuse might fight back in a drastic way. I mean, the burning bed case was 7 or 8 years previous to that, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's at the time, battered women syndrome, as it was starting to be known, that was sort of a new concept that people were, you know, getting, you know, sort of horrifically familiarized with. And so all of this felt like uncharted territory. I know 25 years may not seem like a long time, but we, societally, with regard to these issues, we were in a very different place.
Tell us something. You know, when you see cases like this, there are always reports of the public, people who watch or read in the newspapers, now watching these cases on television, marriage proposals coming in, people drawn to someone like John Wayne Bobbitt and to Lorena. Was this happening at the time?
She received a ton of fan and hate mail to the courthouse. There's a letter that I think it was in... You'll have to forgive me. It's all a blur at this point. But it was in either episode one or two. A letter that she got from a woman that basically said, thank you for doing, please get this to the woman who cut her husband's penis off. She did what I have always wanted to do. And you can imagine that I don't think that that just came from a person who was in healthy, loving relationships. I would imagine that that came from somebody who had experienced the abuse that Lorena claimed that she had experienced.
Okay, what happened is, where is John Wayne Bobbitt today and what does he do?
He's in North Vegas. I couldn't tell you exactly what he does, I've asked him several times. But he's in North Vegas. He has since been, in the years since then, he's been charged and found guilty of abusing several other women on numerous occasions.
Now, when you're putting a project like this together, do you have to make a contract with either of them? Are these people paid for their interviews?
I mean, a person who is part of a scandal like this, you know, their interview is their currency. That's just the way it is. And so that is, that's absolutely part of the way you get an interview with somebody who was part of a huge scandal is, there's a fee for their time, absolutely.
And this is Amazon, is that right?
Yes.
So Amazon believes in taking this to the marketplace.
Oh, very much. I mean, we went around and pitched this to the various networks, and Amazon was the place that we chose because I remember the executives, Tracy Lentz in particular, had such a visceral reaction in the room, and I knew that I just knew that they were who we wanted to make this with.
Now, will either John Wayne Bobbitt or Lorena, is she now Lorena Bobbitt? What is her name now?
Lorena Gallo.
Okay. Okay. Is either of them coming to Sundance?
Yeah, Lorena. Lorena will be here, yeah.
And what do you think, by the way, you know, there's a presentation on Tuesday, and I guess it's the four, not the entire thing, but...
It is the entire thing, all four episodes.
Four episodes.
Yeah.
And what's your feeling about, on TV, you would show this in two parts?
No, it's four episodes.
Four episodes.
You know, coming out the same day, February 15th on Amazon.
How do you feel about an audience sitting down for this? Do you think they will have, you know, the interest to take all this in one chunk?
Oh yeah, I think it's actually the best way to view it. To be honest with you, I've been told it's bingeable for sure. And, I mean, this is by no means unprecedented. Sundance played the O.J. Doc series, which I think was 7.5 hours, and Wild Wild Country, which was 6 hours.
Yeah,
so.
Michael Jackson yesterday.
Yeah, the Michael Jackson doc was 4 hours. So it's, I think that as long as there's a bathroom break in the middle, people are fine.
has somebody tried to do this before, to take on the story and at this length, or at a comparable length?
This length, you
this
said?
This length, yeah.
No. Prior to this, it's only been kind of schlocky outlets who have reached out to Lorena, who just want to give it the sort of salacious tabloid, mm-hmm. you know, expose treatment.
Yeah, where is Jenny Jones? Jenny Jones figures in this. where is she now?
You know, we reached out to her.
If anybody in the audience remembers the talk show host Jenny Jones,
yeah, I did want to interview her. We couldn't track her down, but there are clips from her show. She had John Wayne, and his family and all that kind of stuff on
90s tabloid television.
Absolutely, I mean, all the heavy hitters are there, from Jenny Jones to Geraldo. They're all front and center.
Yeah. They certainly are.
Yeah. Well, let me for those of you in a bingeable mood, Lorena is the one showing in Park City is Tuesday, 11:30 at the Egyptian, and if you can't get to that one, it's also down in Salt Lake, the Broadway Center, on Wednesday nights. It's 4:45 p.m. So two chances to see all 4 hours of this for Lorena and. Director Joshua Fay, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming.
And we're back to Sundance Weekend in the morning with co-host David Darcy and the director of, you know, politically speaking, it might be arguably the film that is attracting the most interest here at the Sundance Festival, Not Down the House. Rachel Lears, please, thank you for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me to start with it. You aimed to document this movement of young progressive Democrats challenging incumbents, and the film starts by following four particular candidates. And it was that the original? How did you choose those particular four to follow, or did you start with eight and it got narrowed down, or what was the original plan?
Well, the original plan was to follow the process of ordinary working people transforming themselves into viable candidates for federal office, and so we started interviewing potential candidates that that had that background, that had not been in political office before, working through two organizations, Brand New Congress and Justice Democrats, that were recruiting them and supporting them. And we ended up looking for people who would be really compelling to watch, win or lose. All of these races were very much long shots in the beginning, so we needed to make sure to get those people that would be really, really great on screen, and that would have personal backstories, a personal experience of injustice or loss, or that were motivating them to run in the first place. So so those were really the kind of criteria we were looking for.
You're talking about the candidates making themselves viable. Was it the candidates who were making themselves viable, or were the circumstances enhancing the viability of the candidates?
You know, that's a great question, and I think it's both. So I think there's a transformation that anyone on a personal level has to do when they're putting themselves out there that way, and each of them had to, you know, find the power within themselves to do that. But absolutely, this is a really volatile and interesting historical moment that we're living through. All bets are off with elections. There's just so much surprise. And
were you surprised by the volatility? Because when they start, things are the only thing that's, they're hoping for that volatility, but we don't see that so much until, you know, the campaigns move a little bit farther ahead. Did you see the opportunity there, or was it more the phenomenon that these were challengers from the outside?
Yeah, I mean, I did see the opportunity. I mean, I saw after seeing what happens with the 2016 election, I really wanted to make a film about people banding together across social divides to change the country in a big way. It really seemed like the time was ripe for that. And so when I saw these people doing that, I really wanted to follow those stories wherever they would go. And they ended up in much more, even more dramatic places than we had imagined.
Okay, now your bio says you have a PhD in cultural anthropology and you're the mother of a 2-year-old son. I'm not going to ask you which came first. But from the academic side, it's very interesting to see this balance, if one could call it that, a relationship between the circumstances and the candidate herself. And, you know, the new catch slogan is not "it's the economy, stupid," but "it's the candidate, stupid." Does that apply to this?
I think that's very astute. So, you know, what we're trying to show in the film is that there are new kinds of people running for office now, people who were not expected to run for office in the past. And it's really about the relationship between money in politics and representation in politics. You know, when it's conventional wisdom that a congressional campaign is going to cost $2 million and a candidate has to have, you know, access to that to be viable, only certain kinds of people are going to run. But when you have these grassroots movements that are supporting candidates with small dollar donations from around the country, it makes it possible for a candidate like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to break through and have that surprise victory.
Yeah, the other thing that struck me is that as candidates that we see that make it to television or radio, more television, that we watch and listen to become over-scripted and driven by, you know, set messages. These were candidates, all of whom could talk really well on their feet and could talk from the heart, which seems to be, I mean, the assumption would be, this is how you get to voters. Is that accurate?
I think that is certainly all of the races we followed. The candidates were connecting with voters on a very personal level. They each had really personal stories and experiences that they shared with their constituents, and that was very much a part of how they ran their campaigns.
But you have the four candidates. How many are here for Sundance?
They are all scheduled to come in today, and we're hoping they all make it.
Okay, so you've got this situation where, as iconic as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is and as appealing as she is, we already have this sort of counter-definition of her in the most savage way, from Fox to the Daily Mail to everywhere. It's as if people were already turning her into the combination of Nancy Pelosi, Bernie Sanders, and George Soros as this icon that they can direct their hatred toward. I mean, how does that fit into your perception of things as a cultural anthropologist?
Oh, interesting question. I mean, I think the sort of context that we're looking to explore in the film is really about the way that there's a new groundswell of grassroots politics happening right now. And these candidates are the face of it. Alexandria in particular has become the face of it. And I think that anyone who is scared of that is going to be putting out vitriol in the media and social media. Our politics is very polarized right now, but what this what the film is really about is a kind of politics that's not left or right, but up and down. It's really, and all of the candidates would say that, it's very much about building a new kind of power in which working people can have true representation in government.
Okay, but it's, as much as it's about these candidates asserting themselves, the other side of it is this inertia or indifference on the part of the Democrats, where you've got people who've been in office for a long time standing there or sitting there or not even being there at all, as we see in the film, and allowing a candidate, since they're so self-assured, they allow a candidate to just occupy that space. Let's not forget that the Republicans did exactly this in Richmond, Virginia several years ago, when Eric Cantor, extremely powerful, we thought, and extremely prominent Republican congressman, had the rug pulled out from under him by a college professor, not to malign academics. And this happens on both sides. And in a way, it's the parallel to what the Democrats allowed to happen when they neglected all these constituencies that Trump ended up winning.
Yeah. The three other women candidates, what are they doing at this point?
They are all still doing a lot of work in their communities, and they all had to find jobs again after running their campaigns, and they'll be updating folks, I think, at the screening tomorrow night about their new plans.
Okay, not down the house. You're getting your premiere, I guess, tomorrow, 6 p.m. at what we call the Mark.
That's
right. And Tuesday at the Prospector Square Theater, Tuesday morning. Back to the Mark on Thursday at 11:30 a.m. Friday the 1st, you're out to the Redstone Cinemas. And then Saturday, you get February 2nd, you're down at Salt Lake. And a lot of people showing up for those.
Well, we hear that it's hard to get tickets for the premiere right now, so that's very exciting. We're just so thrilled to be able to share the film with the audiences here at Sundance.
Do you think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has what it takes to survive these attacks on her?
I do. I think that she's been very, very smart and savvy with media and social media, and she's a very strong person. I think in the film we show, you know, where that comes from in her life, and you have to be really brave to challenge an incumbent in the first place, and that bravery is carrying her through what she's going through now, which I'm sure is super challenging.
I suppose if you've been a bartender, you can see where her fight's coming from.
Yeah. Okay. Director Rachel Lears of Not Down the House, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks, Rachel.
Okay, wrapping up Sundance Reel on the weekend with my co-host, journalist, film critic, and living legend, David Darcy. We got to Where's My Roy Cohn?
Cohn.
With director Matt Turnauer. And apparently, reportedly, Matt, this the title comes from a question that was that Donald Trump had at one point. Where's my Roy Cohn? And to start with, I thought he had a Roy Cohn named Michael Cohen, who said he would take a bullet for Trump and now is promising to sing like a bird about everything he possibly can.
All of these mob overtones and undertones, you know, they're so appropriate. Where's My Roy Cohn wasn't a question, I think. It was a complaint. And it came from Trump, according to the New York Times, when Mueller first started his investigations. And Trump felt undefended. Misunderstanding that the Attorney General is not the president's personal lawyer. He's not his mob lawyer, which the real Roy Cohn had been. And he's not his diabolical political strategist. He's the Attorney General of the United States. And similarly for the White House counsel, he serves the executive. He doesn't serve the president personally. Just some misunderstandings over there in the Oval Office of late. But the film focuses on the said Roy Cohn, and we can get into who that is and why I made the film.
Okay, just give us the however long an answer you want about who Roy Cohn was.
Roy Cohn was the Svengali, the youthful Svengali of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Most remembered until now for whispering in the ear of McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings through the 1950s. Prior to that, as an even younger political operative, he was the prosecutor, one of the prosecutors in the Ethel and Julius Rosenberg spy case. And he inserted himself at a very early age into national politics and was really a superstar of the right and sort of the dark prince of right-wing politics. When McCarthy was discredited, Roy Cohn was discredited along with him through a complicated series of events that are called the Army-McCarthy hearings, which are fascinating. We can get into a little later, but I don't want to digress there. Cohn, his career should have been in ruins, actually, at that point. McCarthy really disappeared from the scene and died soon after that. Not Roy Cohn. He reemerged as a power broker in New York City immediately after the crash and burn of the Army McCarthy period, and became the great behind the scenes political string puller in New York, but also nationally throughout the 60s. But he was also many other things. He was the top mob attorney. He was a master white collar criminal. And he was the chairman of the Favor Bank. And the Favor Bank was the kind of black market of political horse trading in New York and Washington that really kind of legislated what America was, I think. It was a secret political cabal that Roy Cohn, you could almost say, was the chairman of the so-called Favor Bank. He's the ultimate behind-the-scenes string puller player.
Okay, so what we learn are reminded of in the film is the enormous number of people who loved Roy Cohn, but even larger number of people who feared Roy Cohn, which is really what made him most effective. Why is he how did he become fair game when people avoided doing what you were doing for so many years?
Well, it helps that he's dead.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's one.
Well, let me put it. Let's step back for one second. And I think that Roy Cohn would have been a bold footnote in American history if it hadn't been for the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States. Because the big piece of the puzzle that hasn't been spoken yet is that Roy Cohn is also the direct link between Joseph McCarthy and Donald Trump. He was at both of their sides. He was their political advisor. Now, how someone who's been dead, by the way, since 1986, could have such an enormous political impact on us still today is really very much the point of the film, and it connects the dots to show you that. Cohn got away with everything for years because he, like J. Edgar Hoover, one of his mentors, basically kept dark files on people and blackmailed them. And he would probably say, well, everyone does that. Why are you just singling me out? But he was particularly adept at it, and he was operated on scare and fear. And I think he would have been a footnote, Trump having been elected and him having basically tutored Trump and created Donald Trump. We can get into more detail about that, too, makes him the modern Machiavelli of not only the 20th century, but the 21st. And that's really why I made the film.
Yeah, and without Trump, though, we also have the a lot of people may just know the name from Angels in America. Cohn is this kind of, is it fair to say, Shakespearean,
absolutely,
malevolent character?
Yes, and I think that comes across in the film as well. Angels in America, Tony Kushner was, brilliant and prescient. I mean, he got the trope of Roy Cohn early on in the HIV/AIDS period, and Cohn became his metaphor for so many things in this Pulitzer Prize-winning masterpiece that's in the canon. However, this is something written in the 1980s that shows you a sort of sliver of the Roy Cohn who is, in my opinion, a very, very significant player who's touched many parts of American public life, much greater than the character and device that he is in Angels in America.
You know, often we look at characters like Roy Cohn and assume that someone like this is someone who was born poor and is striving for recognition. But really, he was born rich, just like Trump. And talk about that. Where did he come from, and in what way does that create the Roy Cohn that we're going to see in the film?
Yes. Well, this is a film that is really a psychological thriller, it turns out, having a lot to do with Cohn's trajectory. You're right. He's born fabulously wealthy to the richest of the Jewish families in New York who weren't the Our Crowd families. Those were the German Jews who were the Loebs and the banking families. Just below them were the Marcuses and the Cohens. The collection of corporations this family controlled is astonishing. Roy Cohn's great uncle owned or controlled Bank of the United States, which was the big Jewish bank at the time. Another uncle founded Lionel Trains. One uncle controlled Phillips Van Heusen, which was the biggest shirt manufacturer and clothing manufacturer at the time. And then another uncle invented Q-tips. These were the richest Russian Jews at the time. They had a family setback, however, because the Jewish bank, Bank of the United States, was one of the first to crash in the Great Depression. And Roy Cohn's mother, who was the princess of the Bank of the United States in a way, had a come down. And she also had an interesting history. Her cousin, Anne Royfe, the noted memoirist and feminist, refers to Dora Cohn, Roy's mother, as the ugliest girl in the Bronx. This
pretty competitive category.
Well, I won't comment on that. But
now, with Ocasio-Cortez, would she put up with that?
I retract that statement. I have no idea about what the Bronx was like in those days.
Exactly. We shall move on. But the point was that Dora Cohn, though she was the great wealthy princess of this prominent family, couldn't find a husband in the 1920s. This was a major problem. And they arranged a marriage for her with a young, poor law student named Albert Cohen, And out of this apparently loveless marriage, Roy Cohn was the only child. And Dor Cohn was very difficult. He had a kind of like young prince upbringing from a very difficult mother in a really challenging household with lots of psychological problems, which the family, and we interview three cousins in the family, say really helped to shape him and gave him what developed into a major case of narcissistic personality disorder and borderline personality disorder. And I think, leaping ahead here, because there's the elephant in the room, his great mentee, Donald Trump, also born rich from a different kind of wealthy New York family, I think clearly suffers from these same maladies. And I think they fed off of each other in a sick symbiotic relationship at some point.
We're running out of time. Has Trump seen the film?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. Would he participate? Would he? I know you asked him to be interviewed. Would he participate?
Well, he would not. I asked him, I think, four times in three different ways, and he didn't.
Just to give you one more chance at a teaser, does this film have some information on what Roy Cohn privately thought about Trump, and also about what was Trump's reaction when the news that Cohn had AIDS got out?
That's a great question. The movie posits that Roy Cohn might have been in love with Trump. I think it was an unrequited love. It was a bromance, perhaps, but I think Cohn really had a, and you'll see the movie outlines this, a lust for him. And Cohn, of course, Trump is said to have withdrawn his friendship from Cohn when the AIDS diagnosis became public.
Okay. The film has premiered yesterday, and I guess it's at this moment is playing again over at the Temple.
I'm rushing to do the Q&A right after this.
Rushing to get over there, and also a showing in Salt Lake on Sunday the 27th. So thank you for capping off our show, Dan Termeyer.
Matt Turnauer.
Matt Turnauer. Matt sorry. Matt, Dan, what the heck.
Great to be here.
It is.
Thank you.
KPCW Park City with Sundance in the Morning.
Matt, thank you.
Thank you.